In April of 2015, the Defense Prisoner of War Missing in Action Accounting Agency announced a lofty new plan. 73 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the agency would return to the scene of the disaster and perform a duty that, for multiple reasons, wouldn't have been possible in 1941. With the help of both historical records and modern technology, the agency set out to attach a name to the remains of the 388 victims of the USS Oklahoma who were left unidentified following the aftermath of that fateful day. Of the 429 men killed aboard the Oklahoma that morning, only 35 were ever fully identified in the years that followed. The rest, the hundreds of men who were lost when their ship suddenly capsized, were buried on Oahu inside plain wooden coffins in mass graves with headstones marked unknown. And now, a full 75 years after their final chapter ended, their story is finally receiving its epilogue. I'm Corey Constable, and this is Omitted. Lewis Wagner was the second eldest of the 8 sons born to Marion and Myrtle Wagner. 8 sons. Can we, just for a moment, imagine how stressful Myrtle's life must have been? 8 sons born and raised in Butler County, Kansas, wrestling and fighting and making their own fun like any Midwestern farm boy has to. But it's pretty easy to have fun when you have 7 brothers. There's always someone to play with, always someone to torment, or at least someone who will torment with you. At the age of 15, Lewis Wagner left school and stayed home to help his father around the farm. Marion was a straightforward, no-nonsense sort of man. The kind of dad whose punishments meant the boys got to pick their own switch off the willow tree before being swatted. The kind of dad who knew that the psychological aspect of having to choose your own was a worse punishment than the spanking itself. But the boys earned their red swat marks, for sure. Every Halloween while they were teenagers, they'd sneak out of the house, run down the road to their neighbor's farm, circle his outhouse, and 3, 2, 1, they'd whisper. And then they'd lift that outhouse up off its foundation and move it backward just a few feet. Not far enough for the neighbor to really notice, but just enough that when he got up in the middle of the night to do his business, he'd fall into the hole. So they did this for years. And for years, the neighbor would call their father the next day and the boys would choose their switch off the willow tree. And they'd laugh about it until the next Halloween when they'd do it all over again. But then one year, the neighbor got clever. He knew what was coming. After years of the same routine, he knew that the boys would be there that Halloween night, so he preemptively moved the outhouse himself. He picked it up and moved it forward just a few feet. And when the brothers showed up that evening, the neighbor heard one of them yell some curse words, followed by cackling laughter from the rest of the boys. Lewis Wagner had fallen into the hole himself, and the neighbor knew he'd finally gotten even. But that's the type of kid that Lewis Wagner was. The kind who was ready to make his own fun and create his own adventure and pay the repercussions as a result. And I think that maybe explains why he found himself at Pearl Harbor in 1941. I think that, even though he knew the United States was on the brink of war, he felt that every attempt at fun brought with it the risk of consequence. When he turned 18, he left his family home in Kansas and headed west aboard a ship in California. The USS Oklahoma, launched in 1914, was his new home for the next 2 years. He spent nearly the entirety of his term in Honolulu, participating in drills and patrol exercises, and only returned to the United States mainland once, in August of 1941 when the ship was en route to Los Angeles to be outfitted with new armor. They were struck by a storm and one man was swept overboard, and the propeller shaft was damaged enough to force them to stop instead in San Francisco, the closest port with a dry dock they could reach. In October of 1941, after the damages had finally been repaired, the Oklahoma left the mainland for the final time and headed for Hawaii. On December 7th, the Oklahoma was moored alongside the USS Maryland in Battleship Row. Within the first few minutes of the attack, the ship was struck by 3 torpedoes and water began flowing in on its port side. As the Oklahoma quickly fell below the waves, stunned officers and crew, who hadn't even had time to register what was happening, became trapped in the interior of the ship. 2 more torpedoes struck the Oklahoma, and the fate of those men was sealed. Lewis Wagner was not stuck within the ship, however. According to a friend who'd been with him on board that morning, Wagner had found his way to the deck by the time the ship sank. The men scrambled to the highest point they could in an effort to stay above the waves, but as the Japanese planes made low passes overhead, firing their guns at them, the pair realized they would have to jump. Lewis Wagner was athletic. He was fit. But even though he was in the Navy, he wasn't a very strong swimmer. He died before reaching the USS Maryland. In the months that followed, Lewis's family pried the Navy for any information they could find. But a pair of telegrams confirming that their son was missing and that he was never identified were the only word they would ever receive. Lewis's body was collected from the wreckage of the USS Oklahoma, along with the bodies of over 400 other men. Whether he'd been injured to the point that identification was impossible, or whether he'd simply left the ship without any record of his identity, we can't be certain. But in the weeks and the years that followed, the remains of over 1,000 men were collected from the waters of Pearl Harbor. So many men that, given the time constraints and the decomposition, and the amount of resources available to dedicate to a project like this, it simply wasn't feasible to attach a name to every single one. He was buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, in a single casket with a handful of other men. They were given a grave marker that read, "Unknowns, USS Oklahoma, Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941. In the decades that followed, Lewis's parents and his 7 brothers all held out hope. They held out hope that he would someday be identified, that they'd be able to bring his body home and lay it to rest in his home state with a proper burial alongside the rest of the family. So when the Navy announced their plans to exhume the bodies of those USS Oklahoma victims, his brothers Carl and Merle were quick to answer the call. They took swabs of their DNA and sent it off to a laboratory in Nebraska, where it was compared with the mitochondrial DNA pulled from the teeth and the bones of the skeletons in those unmarked graves. And in 2016, there was a match. Carl Wagner, only 12 years old when his brother was killed in action, received word that Lewis's body had been positively identified. He was, unfortunately, the only remaining Wagner boy. On the 6th of October 2016, he left his home in Utah to travel with his daughter to his home state of Kansas, where nearly 75 years after his death, Lewis Wagner's plane finally touched down. As the aircraft rolled down the runway, a pair of yellow fire trucks shot streams of water overhead, and the family stood by at a distance as 6 Navy officers unloaded the casket and draped an American flag onto its top. Lewis Wagner was buried in his family plot at the Whitewater Cemetery, alongside 3 of the brothers he'd left back home. After 3/4 of a century in an unmarked grave, his obituary was written, and he was given the proper funeral his family had always dreamed he'd have. The very next week, hundreds of mourners gathered together in the town square of Keene, New Hampshire. They waved American flags as they watched a motorcade from Boston pass through the center of their small town. Fire trucks created an arch over the street. Boy Scouts saluted. A military bugler played taps as the hearse passed by. Just like Lewis Wagner, a man named Edwin Hopkins was finally returning home. At the age of 18 in 1940, he dropped out of school and left home to join the Navy. While the town of Keene is a New Englander's paradise during the fall, back in 1940, On the heels of the Great Depression, there were very few jobs for young men with ambition. His brother had joined the Navy 6 months prior, and feeling as though he had no other option, Eddie followed in his footsteps. On his enlistment papers, he wrote that he was joining the military because he wanted to learn a trade. After 3 months of training in Rhode Island and Detroit, he boarded a train for the West Coast and awaited his orders. On September 9, 1941, he sent his last letter home. It was a postcard showing the USS Oklahoma with a message on the back scrawled in messy cursive. "Dear folks, here is the picture of the ship I am going to be on. I am writing this Monday afternoon at the lakes. We are all ready to leave at 9 o'clock. We don't expect to get to San Francisco till Friday night because we are not going on a special train. Love, Eddie." It was the last time his family ever heard from him. Following the attack, Frank and Alice Hopkins received just as little word as Marion and Myrtle Wagner. Two telegrams with condolences, but not much in the way of information. And they never really talked about him after they accepted what happened. Typical New Englanders, it seems that they decided instead to hide their pain and their grief behind a smile, to put it out of their minds and let it all go. And for the most part, Eddie's brother did the same. He kept tight-lipped, never really telling his children about the uncle they'd never met, about the man after whom Edwin Hopkins Jr. had been named. Eddie's niece, Faye Bohr, looked for clues. She dug through her grandparents' possessions, hoping that she'd find something, anything, to give her a sense of what sort of man her uncle had been. All she could find was that one final postcard, though. As her father, Eddie's brother, began to slip away with dementia, he finally opened up. He told Faye of the one-room schoolhouse he and Eddie had attended as children, about the fun they had ice skating on frozen ponds, about the time Eddie decided he wanted to raise a calf for the county 4-H fair, and how he thought it was just hilarious to name it Helicopter Petunia. He told her that, in 1942, their mother, Alice, hired a psychic to communicate with her son, to make sure that he had safely passed on to the other side. The psychic told Alice that there was indeed someone there with them, a young man. He was wet, and his hair stood up in the back. Just like the cowlick Alice had tried for years, in vain, to flatten down onto the back of his head. I don't know if Alice Hopkins received the closure she wanted from that psychic. She never told anyone. No one who knew him while he was alive had the opportunity to see Eddie's story come to a close. By the time his funeral service was held at Hopkins Delant Airport, named in his honor, everyone who had ever known him was dead. But still, on a chilly autumn day, hundreds of people gathered together in the town square, waving American flags and watching as his coffin returned home. Through 2016, scenes like this one played out 30 times across the U.S. Men who died at Pearl Harbor were brought home to states they'd left 80 years earlier, and finally interred in cemeteries alongside family who died feeling that they would never be reunited. But there's one body in particular that will never be recovered. It doesn't remain unidentified, and it wasn't even a Pearl Harbor victim. But this individual's story is linked to the harbor in an unlucky way that I feel I can't finish this season without discussing. All 8 of the Navy battleships at Pearl Harbor were damaged on the morning of December 7th. 4 of those ships sank completely. Eventually, all but 2 of them were brought back to the surface. 1,500,000 visitors to Pearl Harbor every year step foot onto a boat over to the USS Arizona, with its stark white memorial floating solemnly above it. But just around the northern edge of Ford Island lie the despairingly unvisited remains of the USS Utah. The ship was meant to be sunk, After 30 years in service, it was being stripped of its valuables and about to enter its new life as a vessel for target practice. For that reason alone, the ship was low on staff. Aboard the Utah that morning was a man named Albert T.D. Wagner. Wagner had been in the Navy for some time, stationed in the Philippines where his wife and his family remained. Shortly before receiving his orders to report to Pearl Harbor, his wife had given birth to twin girls, born premature and weighing only 3 pounds each. Mary Wagner survived, but 2 days later her twin sister Nancy passed away. The family was devastated, of course, but with a fragile new baby to care for, they did their best to hold it together. Nancy's tiny body was cremated, and the ashes were given to her father. Albert took the ashes in their copper urn and brought them with him to Hawaii, intending to spread them at sea near the harbor he'd come to love so dearly. The chaplain was supposed to come aboard and go out to sea and they would have the ceremony, Mary says. That ceremony never came, though. As the USS Utah fell under attack on December 7th, with 3 torpedoes striking the ship within the first 5 minutes, Albert Wagner simply didn't have time to return to his crew locker. With the captain giving orders to abandon ship and the Utah falling hard on its side, all he could do was make his escape. His daughter's ashes were left aboard the ship, and to this day, that's where they remain. 58 men died aboard the Utah that morning, and most of them remain there still. The vessel had no military value. It was on its way out. So the Navy has left it to rust away in the location where it sank 75 years ago. But every December, Mary Wagner Cree returns to Ford Island. Every year, she pulls a flower from a wreath and drops it into the water beside the ship. Every year, she thanks the survivors for their service, and thanks the victims for watching over the sister she never got the chance to know. "It is so peaceful and quiet," she says. "I wouldn't want her anyplace else." I guess, in the end, it matters less where your body ends up than it does that your family has somewhere to pay their respects to it.